Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we discuss the issue at the heart of England's defence. We'll ask if £150 million is a reasonable price for Declan Rice. We'll talk about the ethical line when it comes to choosing Chelsea's new owners. There's an update on the Women's Champions League and the search for a new manager at Manchester United. This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back to the Game Football Podcast. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, alongside Tom Clark and Jonathan Northcroft. We'll be speaking a little bit later to Molly Hudson as well. We've got to start by talking about the international break, of course. England playing friendlies with Switzerland and Ivory Coast over the next 5 or 6 days. Both games at Wembley, first one on Saturday. But I have been thinking about the England defence. And I think a lot of people have been thinking about the England defence because there have been a raft of withdrawals in this squad. And if you look at the players who are still there, I think it's going to be a bit of an issue. You've got Harry Maguire and John Stones, of course. Tyrone Mings and Connor Cody, who seem to get picked in every Southgate squad. Arsenal's Ben White is there. There's a first call up for Crystal Palace's Mark Gahey. Even when you look at the fullbacks, Tyrick Mitchell and Carl Walker-Peters have just been called in due to withdrawals. Luke Shaw is there. He's been out of form. After the number of withdrawals, it is a great chance to experiment, as Paul Joyce has been writing in the Times, but he feels it will be a missed opportunity given the number of players who now aren't there. Tom Clark, what do you think about it? Because I think fans might expect Harry Maguire to be dropped on form, John Stones over a lack of game time. Should we see a new look England defence?
I mean, it's been a while since we've talked about the England defence, isn't it, Hugh? You were saying you've been thinking about it. It brings me back to those great old days before the Euros. see if we can get through this without mentioning everyone's favourite term, back three. I mean, lots of points to go out there that you've raised. I would say the first one, Harry Maguire, is a big talking point. But I do wonder with him whether Gareth Southgate is doing what he has done with other players, Raheem Sterling, perhaps, for example, before the Euros, being in and out of the Man City team. Southgate stuck by him and was rewarded. And there are lots of players who, for whom club form may be on the wane, but then they seem to produce for England. So maybe that's what Southgate is going for with Maguire, though undoubtedly on form, he perhaps could, you could argue he shouldn't even be in the squad. I think you mentioned Paul Joyce's piece there that's on the Times today, talking particularly about Trent Alexander-Arnold. You know, this would have been a great opportunity to test that theory about him playing as a right back in a back four at international level, because he's been superb this season. You know, we discussed on a recent show, almost does it even matter that we have to debate his defending when he's so good going forward and his passing ability? That is a real shame that he's dropped out of these matches, as you say. I'm not necessarily sure I'm in the kind of worried camp about England's defence going into a World Cup. For me, John Stones, I've been a big fan of John Stones before. I think at the Euros, he proved what a top-level elite defender he is. I think he is a kind of nailed-on defender. But I think the Maguire factor does pose an interesting debate. The absence from the squad of Fikayo Tomori, for me, is an interesting talking point as well. You've got a guy there he's 24, he's been in squads before. I think he's made one debut maybe game against Kosovo, I think it was. And he's, by all accounts, performing very well for AC Milan in Serie A this season. I had a quick look at his stats before coming on. 22 appearances. He's kind of fifth for tackles of all defenders in Serie A. You know, that kind of thing. Getting praise from Franco Baresi. And also, I spotted an interview, I'm sure lots of you saw it as well, of him speaking in Italian during a post-match interview, which again very much fits the mold of bright young lad, which definitely seems to be a factor, doesn't it, under Gareth Southgate. He likes impressive people as well as impressive footballers. So that to me is a surprise. I would have had Tomori in over Mings or White, say. So, but I think there's options there. I don't think it's as doom and gloom as perhaps some people are wondering. But Paul Joyce is right, and you're right. It's not the ideal preparation and not the ideal situation for a couple of friendly games where you should be experimenting.
Johnny, it feels to me like Gareth Southgate has prioritised players who are good with their feet in central defence. When you look at the players that are there, Mark Gahey, who's been brought in, is very good with his feet, and maybe that's one area at least that he has a positive compared to Fakaia Tomori, who's not bad with his feet by any stretch of the imagination, but maybe he thinks Gahey can offer something different there. You've got Mings, who's got balance with the left foot, and Cody, who was a natural midfielder as a youngster, whose passing is pretty good as well, and then you've got Stones and Maguire, who've impressed in that area. Do you think we need to prioritise out-and-out old-school defending?
Well, I do think this comes down to a question of formation. So I'm sorry, I'm going to mention the back three.
Hey, he's gone in.
Well, I think there's one of the most fundamental decisions, if not the most fundamental decision, that Gareth has to make ahead of this World Cup is, you know, he's had two tournaments now where, although using a back four at times in qualifying, he's defaulted to the back three, and it's served him extremely well. But it's served him well in the way that we've all observed, as in it's made England very hard to beat, and it's allowed England to grind the way to a certain level, but not quite get over the line. So I think one of the biggest issues is he going to go for it a third time? And if so, we're going to, you know, he's then going to kind of rely on trying to do marginally better what he's already done at two tournaments. Now, if that's a decision, and I think it will be the decision, and I think that's why Harry Maguire is still almost his number one defender, because Gareth loves his ability. Not that we've seen it much for Man United this season, because his confidence is so short. But he loves Maguire's ability to come out and break the lines when he steps out with the ball. And, you know, you mentioned Tomori. I mean, Chris Smalling could never get a look in when he was at his best for Roma, for the same reasons that Gareth doesn't look at, or rather, he does look at ball-playing centre-halves ahead of out-and-out defenders because of this inclination towards the back three. That's why Gahey and White are such interesting prospects for him, though, because they're both extremely good with the ball, both extremely calm a temperament. You could see them playing in tournaments. You could see them adjusting tactically to the demands. And they're just in that much better form than Harry Maguire. So I think it's right that Maguire's in the squad. I think, you know, as Tom said, Gareth has done well with the philosophy of trying to have a club England and reward people that have done well for England. It's worked for him. But there comes a point where someone's lack of form becomes critical, and you do risk it spilling over in the international stage. And I'd like to see Gahey and White get meaningful chances in these internationals, not be the guys that, you know, come on for the second half against Ivory Coast on next Tuesday night, but, you know, get meaningful chances, be put in with John Stones if he goes four at the back, or you know, be put in with Stones and Maguire in the Switzerland game straight up, which is probably England's sort of the bigger one of the two, just because it's a Saturday fixture, and you know, Switzerland ranks slightly higher, I think, than Ivory Coast. So I think that there has to be meaningful chances, because you can't, even if you want, I think emotionally he wants to start this World Cup with Stones and Maguire, but that would be a gamble as it stands, the way Harry Maguire's form is going. I think he has to have meaningful alternatives. You mentioned Mings and Cody. Their role is sort of pretty clear as kind of elder statesmen of the squad, and therefore, you know, the sort of culture aspects and so on. But he's made it clear that he doesn't see them as tournament starters. We know that. So I think White and Gahey are great options for England to now have, and they have to be given a proper chance in these games.
I think the same. It's strange. I think Ben White is a good player who could be a very good player. I haven't yet seen signs that he's going to be a world beater as a central defender, particularly in a four. But I do think his form deserves a chance with England. I do think you know, alongside Gabriel, I do think they complement one another quite well. It's whether you can find a player that goes along with the skill set of Ben White for England quite well. But I do think he can play at this level and have an effect for England. His confidence seems to be growing. I would start him in both of these two matches for sure. Would you, Tom?
I'm less convinced about Ben White, to be honest. I think I have been probably the biggest cheerleader for Mikel Arteta's Arsenal this season on this podcast, haven't I? But that's the one area for me, in terms of both the recruitment and the performances on the pitch, that still feels a little bit uncertain. I think he wasn't great in that game against Watford where they just won 3-2. I still don't think he looks quite like, you know, that kind of leader, that talismanic central defender that all these kind of top six clubs are trying to find and that Manchester United tried to find with Harry Maguire. I don't think he's that. I think arguably he's the kind of defender that needs a player alongside him. I just wonder whether, you know, whether England would be better off going with Gaye on the point of that he's different to Maguire. Don't try and replicate the kind of Stones-Maguire thing. If you're going to switch, why not look for strengths elsewhere? You know, Gaye's turn of pace, his ability on the ball, as Johnny says, you know, try to find and build something different rather than who can be my next best Stones and Maguire, who can be my next best Harry Maguire, because, you know, ultimately, and this is where a lot of debates around this England team and why, you know, Scottish fans like Johnny start rolling their eyes and getting bored, because we have lots of talented players. But that's why Southgate always goes back to Raheem Sterling, despite the plethora of attacking talent, because at international level, you want experience. You want players who've been in these games. So it's going to be hard in some respects for these players to displace Harry Maguire just on that point, because Southgate will look at the options and go, okay, experience, who matches him? Connor Cody, but he's not as good at this. Okay, who matches him at this? But he's not got the other attribute. So it'll be hard. And I almost wonder whether you'd be better off going with a completely different option to try that out, because you're always going to come back to Maguire in some respects.
No, I agree with you. But actually, I think England need to think of life without Maguire very soon. You can't keep making the argument he hasn't let the country down when his form's this bad, because if it continues in this vein, it is only a matter of time until he lets the country down. And if his form gets any worse, you know, there will be arguments over whether he should even be in the England squad. And you can't keep really arguing, well, he hasn't put a foot wrong for the country. I do think you need another option. And again, I agree with Johnny. I don't care if it's a different system. But if he has a crisis of confidence like he's had at Manchester United with the England team, you can't put him in the team, even if it's for the World Cup, as good as he has been. You can't. You just can't. Imagine his form for England replicates his form for Manchester United. You think he still warrants a starting place?
I completely agree with you, but I go back to that point about, and this is kind of echoing some of the thoughts I had before the Euros, you know, all hail Gareth, trust in Southgate. Because you do have that sense that it almost works in Southgate's favour. I'm not saying that he wants players to be out of form and kind of confidence shot, but take Maguire, you know, think about the season he had before the Euros. There was lots of question marks over him, you know, on and off the field. There were points in the season where he looked in a really bad place, and yet he still performed. I almost wonder with England, with players like Maguire, where Southgate kind of goes, come on, son, don't worry, you're in a safe place now. I'm here. We'll get you back. We'll get you back. And I just think he almost fosters that feeling. I'm not saying it's a kind of no one likes you, I don't care type thing, as the kind of adapted version of the famous chant, but I do think that weirdly helps Southgate and seems to bring out the best in certain players. So I agree with you, he's in awful form, but I don't necessarily think with players of his experience, Southgate necessarily minds that much. And I actually think sometimes he gets the best out of them in those situations.
Johnny, when it comes to experimenting in these two games, aside from the defence, do you think we should see more of the fringe players playing in these two games? Should we see some of the new, younger faces, see what they've got at this level?
It's a difficult one because I think there's players who we have seen, for example, Bukayo Saka, who's been playing so well, that you actually want to see more of and in combinations with the likes of a Foden and a Harry Kane playing as Harry Kane's playing now and not the kind of slightly below Harry Kane that we had at the Euros. So, I mean, there's combinations there with established players that would be great to see worked on, semi-established players. But, I mean, Joyce's article today sets it out really clearly that there's very, very little time now to try people, to experiment. The next round of internationals will be just after the Champions League final. There'll probably be a huge number of call-offs. And then you're suddenly into World Cup run-up. So I suppose you know, Tammy Abraham's the big miss, isn't it? This would have been the one for him to get a proper chance to bed himself down. I don't think there's not one name that really compelling name completely outside of the squad that comes to mind that I think has to be given a chance. It's more Bellingham's another one. It's more guys that have had a little bit of a chance so far but aren't starters yet, but I think should really be looked at as starters for the World Cup. Bellingham and Saka would be the two that I think they should be forefronted at these internationals.
Johnny, this isn't a dig about your age in relation to me and Hugh, I promise, but you have been in the game a bit longer than us, and particularly, you know, at the level of kind of correspondent, which means you follow England. Can you remember, you know, because as fans and as journalists, and as you know my position as an editor, these international weeks are like, what can we talk about? What can we debate? And part of it comes around these young players who are going to break in.
Yeah.
Can you remember times in a lead up to a tournament where a player in these kind of friendly games did kind of come from the pack? Because to me, I was thinking back, and yes, there are players that break in before a tournament, but they're either at the Wayne Rooney level of just absolutely you can't leave them out. I can't remember necessarily anywhere at international level they get game time in friendlies and suddenly go, huh, this guy. Can you think of any? I mean, difficult off the top of your head, maybe.
Well, not really. I mean, before the World Cup, actually, it was these internationals, the spring ones, where Gareth first put Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard together, which was what we saw in the World Cup. And I think Lingard had played a couple of times. Of course, he wasn't a young player, and Dele was well known as a talent. But you do see combinations sometimes come through. But yeah, I mean, like the Rooneys and Rashford came very late into Euro 2016. I think he didn't play until the summer internationals before the tournament. I think that if you look at the history of it, that these March or April ones are often where people play themselves out of squads. And I think I go back to 96, and I think Letizia was given eight. I mean, Venables didn't really want him and gave him almost like the hospital pass international at Wembley. It was at Hungary or something like that. And, you know, almost sort of set him up to, not set him up to fail, but was able to use that as a, right, I've given him a chance and now he's not playing. The thing with Gareth is to be fair to him, he does try so many young players that compared to covering previous managers where, you know, let's say it's a Capello or even, you know, going back and Sven, and you kind of, you know, come on, he's got to think outside the, he's got to think outside the big six clubs. He's got to think outside the established group and give this guy a chance. To be fair to Gareth, he gets him in so quickly that he doesn't leave you a lot to write about really in those senses. I think when it all comes down to what we're looking at is an established manager who's now going to his third tournament, who's done really well at the other two, who's got a stable team, and I don't think we're going to see a great number of changes to anything. And we'll have to try and debate it. We'll have to try and find talking points in the papers, but it's going to be hard. I think we're kind of, we could probably ink in eight or nine of the starters in that first World Cup game already.
Oh, I mean, I would love to see a new midfield. Conor Gallagher in there with Jude Bellingham maybe in one of the games. I think we all know that likely to be in holding midfield come what may is going to be Declan Rice. And he's been hitting the headlines today, of course, with the England squad, but with his club West Ham United as well. £150 million is reportedly the asking price for those who want to buy Declan Rice this summer. Rice has 2 years left on his contract in the summer, and the club is able to extend it for a further year after that. So there's no real reason for this sale to be urgently happening, but I think it has reached a point that his talents are going in a certain direction and West Ham maybe feel like they can cash in at a very high point. For me, £150 million is an extremely high point. So the first question really is this a fair price for the talents of Declan Rice? Johnny, what do you think?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, so, okay, we've got a new TV deal, and we've just had a January where, you know, the net spend was an all-time record for the Premier League. And at this point in time, everyone's going to be quoting the highest possible prices because there hasn't been that deal that's set the benchmark yet. So I know exactly, I understand exactly why West Ham would quote that price. I guess they might benchmark it against Jack Grealish and say, look, you know, £100 million for a fringe player, Declan Rice is much more important to England, blah, blah, blah. Don't forget as well, this is the summer of transition at West Ham. This is where Mark Noble kind of hold hands over the, you know, golden bubble to Declan Rice, and he becomes the keeper of West Ham, sort of thing. So, you know, this is important for them to keep him culturally and of course on the pitch. And knowing the manager, I know how much he loves Declan Rice, it would be the very, very last deal he'd want to see done would be Declan Rice leaving. So for all those reasons, and you've mentioned the contract, it has to be a high price, And the only way to knock that price down, I guess, would be either if the owners budged, and I think that might be an issue, or whether the player agitated, and I can't see Declan Rice doing that.
So, was there a direct answer to the question there, John?
He's worth 150 million, because my mate says so.
Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I think he is worth that. In the modern context football, of English players, I think in terms of his age, 23, in terms of the progression he's shown, I think West Ham are fully justified in demanding that as the figure. Obviously, lots of bits of context that go into it that Johnny said, so I won't repeat them. We hinted there with the discussion around England, around our position as journalists and creating debates sometimes. And this one with Declan Rice kind of feels like the next move for Declan Rice. Declan Rice's next move can be to stay at West Ham. There's absolutely no doubt about that from my point of view. He could maybe sign a contract extension or a new improved contract. Gary Jacob is writing a piece today, reportedly on around £75,000 a week. For his status as a player, he could justify more than that. West Ham are two seasons now, been pushing at the right end of the table. And when you look around, why on earth would Declan Rice be going to Manchester United when he only needs to look at players like Harry Maguire, Jadon Sancho and others to think, why on earth would I go there? Situation at Chelsea is increasingly unpredictable despite being linked with them quite a lot. They've got a lot of midfield talent already. Why would you go there unless they suddenly said, okay, we're going to get rid of Kante and Jorginho? If Manchester City and Liverpool don't want you, stay where you are, Declan. You've got plenty of time. I know there'll be the argument he wants to go and win trophies. He might win a trophy at West Ham or he can move in 2 years' time. Declan Rice's next move can be just stay where you are.
Waste of time to stay at West Ham United, unfortunately, because they're not going to do anything. They're not going to do anything.
But then, all right, and count my point with £120 million move to the new Manchester United under their new manager, and in 3 years' time, he's done nothing equal.
I wouldn't say to him to go to Manchester United either. No, but go ahead, Johnny.
Look, next season, Declan Rice could be in the Champions League, having already won the Europa League. You know, which is more than United and a couple of other suitors would be able to offer. So I don't buy that he has to leave West Ham to succeed or win trophies.
No, yeah, but I just don't know what is, you know, okay, if they get to the Champions League, I think he might stay for one extra year. But ultimately, I think if a decent move is on for him, he would want to do it. I think most players would. I think £150 million is hugely inflated by about 50 million quid. Listen, 80 to 100 million pounds, just so we're all clear, is a huge amount of money for a football player and would put him amongst the most expensive players there have ever been. And he's a very good player. He is a very good player, but he plays in a position where you don't spend 150 million pounds on players. And I think that is part of it as well. It's, you know, people go, he's worth 150 million because he's brilliant. He's a match winner. Yeah, he is. But he still plays quite deep in central midfield area. He's not spraying 50-yard balls. He's not having loads of assists. He doesn't get loads of goals. As great as he is at what he does, you do not invest £150 million in a player that does what he does. Because truly, you could go out with 50, 60, 70 million and get a player who might not be as good as him, but does a lot of what he does. It just isn't a good investment to spend that much money on Declan Rice. 80 to 100, I'd say Manchester United probably need him for that amount of money. And if that's the difference, then yeah. But I think if you're talking over £100 million for Declan Rice, something's gone wrong here. I mean, really,
yeah,
Tom?
I think you're right. But there is, you know, Johnny and I both, I've referenced his age. That is a fact. 23-year-old English player who's been up and up and up and up and up. That, you know, they shouldn't be factored into transfer price tags, but they are. They always are. They will be with Bukayo Saka as we debate, will he sign a contract or will he not at Arsenal? Just, and I agree with you, say if you're Manchester United, take that 100 million, 150 million and go and buy Ruben Neves from Wolves and, you know, another midfielder from Europe
Bellingham,
instead.
Neves.
Yeah, exactly.
Tchouameni.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. But what I would say in Rice's defence, in terms of spending a hell of a lot of money on him if you were to try and prize him away from West Ham. And I say this speaking as someone who on this podcast probably about 2 years ago said he should be a defender, not a midfielder. And has then probably, of all my predictions and comments on this podcast that have been proved wrong, that is right up there. He continues to improve and advance his game. He started off in that midfield position as a kind of ball-winning player. But now you're seeing him. You said he's not kind of spraying passes. I think he's starting to add that to his game. He's starting to take the ball forward. He's starting to add goals to his game as well. I'm not saying he's going to become, I don't know, producer John, please don't clip this up for social media. I'm not saying he's going to become Kevin De Bruyne, but he is adding more and more to his game. So you could see at 26, you've got a modern, complete midfielder who's got a background in defending, who's got an incredible athleticism, but is starting to add to his game assist, goals and assists as well. So that's, again, where you could justify a huge club going, do you know what, this guy is going to be the best midfielder in the Premier League for the next 9 years. 120 million is a bargain.
Yeah, just to add to that, you've also got to remember that there are two prices, really. There's what someone's worth to a buying club, and you can debate whether it's worth 150 million for a player of his ilk, but I actually think for a lot of the reasons Tom said it might be, but there's a value of somebody to the selling club, and it's a bit like, I remember speaking to Steve Parrish about Wilf Zaha a couple of years ago, and his take was Wilf Zaha is priceless to Crystal Palace. You know, there isn't a transfer fee you could give me that would actually be commensurate with his value to us as a football club, and I think that's where Declan Rice is for West Ham. You know, he is invaluable to them. So that's why their price is going to be high, if David Moyes has any sense in saying it anyway, so high that it almost puts off buyers.
Yeah, I think it is very, very high. I think it is the sort of price that would price him out of a move, and maybe quite deliberately. You get him to sign a new deal, you include a release clause in it that's probably above £100 million. And you probably get that money with clubs knowing, look, if you pay this fee, he'll be yours and there won't be a transfer saga. And maybe the year after or the year after that. But I mean, 150 million, if he goes for that, honestly, my jaw will be on the floor, as good a player as he is. And it will probably be to Manchester United, and we'll be talking about it on the podcast. But there you go. One of the other clubs, like you mentioned, that he was linked to, Declan Rice, is Chelsea. All the news about them is about their new owners this week. I just wanted to ask a particular question around something I've seen on social media this week when it comes to the reaction of the Chelsea fans to one set of prospective new owners, because it got me thinking about where the line is. Let me explain it to you. It's emerged that the Ricketts family, they own the Chicago Cubs baseball team, and they also have the considerable financial backing of the billionaire hedge fund manager Ken Griffin, have already sent a delegation into London to meet with representatives from the Chelsea Pitch Owners PLC and the Chelsea Supporters Trust this week. The Ricketts bid is considered to be amongst the favourites, but it has caused a bit of controversy because Joe Ricketts, who isn't meant to be involved with the sale, he's the father of the Ricketts family, if you like, he was forced to publicly apologise for describing Muslims as his enemy in leaked emails back in 2019. Henceforth, this week, the hashtag No to Ricketts campaign was trending on social media. In response to that backlash, the Ricketts family released a statement saying, "Our family rejects any form of hate in the strongest possible terms. Racism and Islamophobia have no place whatsoever in our society. We have developed deep and abiding partnerships with the Muslim community in Chicago, as well as all communities of color. Respect for diversity and inclusion are central to our family's values. If we prevail in our bid for Chelsea, we commit to the club and to the fans that we will actively promote these values." But it did get me thinking about a big decision that's going to be made this week as we get a much smaller shortlist of Chelsea bidders. What's being considered? Should morality and ethics be considered this week in the shortlisting of the potential new owners? I don't know whether there should be an ethical consideration, but I did want to ask you guys. Johnny, what do you think?
I think there has to be, and I think this is a great opportunity because this is, by accident almost, something that the public theoretically has a say in, because government have a role to play in rubber stamping it. And, you know, hopefully what we've learned from the last few weeks and the meltdown caused by Abramovich and you know, the soul searching the game's been doing about ownerships and sports washing and all that sort of stuff is that, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had looked closer at owners in the past, and shouldn't we look more closely going forward? I think this is an opportunity to factor in somebody's just fitness as a leader of an institution to take over a club. And there are lots of factors that come into that, but one of them has got to be how they would represent a fan base and how they would sort of stack up in terms of all the stuff that we talk about. And you know, diversity is an enormous thing. You know, we've campaigned and talked about in the game. So I'm not saying that the Ricketts family can't buy Chelsea, but I think it would be right for Chelsea fans, let's say, to be reflected in that, and for that family to have to win them over and provide reassurances on the basis of what we've seen so far from those leaked emails.
See, I agree with you on that. I think that there need to be rules around the owners and directors that include an ethical consideration and bring in any of these, you know, there was an apology from the Ricketts family at the time, even if you call it a gaffe, I think these things do need to be examined. Any potential owners need to be examined in terms of things that they've said publicly and especially things like diversity and inclusion. So I do think there needs to be a rule brought in, but that rule doesn't currently exist. And I don't think this week that the prospective new owners of Chelsea should be held to a higher standard than the owners that have come in during this season in the Premier League at other clubs. I don't see how that's fair. And I know people say you can't talk about fairness here, but Chelsea have the chance of possibly, and look, I'm only reading about this, you know, if these people are among the favourites to take over, people clearly think the bid that they are making is structured and solid in some way. They might miss the owner that allows them to stay as the Chelsea we currently know on these grounds. But Newcastle United, for example, when their new owners came in just a few months ago, didn't have to. And I don't think that this week, unless you bring in new rules for every single new owner that comes into football or the Premier League, if you like, unless those rules exist, I don't think the new owners should be examined by rules that don't. I just don't see how that is fair. And I know, like, again, fairness is a really strange thing when we're talking about these clubs and these billionaires and the people that have been in football. But I want there to be an ethical consideration across the board. I just don't see how you apply it this week when you haven't applied it to other clubs. What do you think, Tom?
I think you both raise interesting points. And I think if I was playing the grumpy old man role that I often do, I'd say, well, ethics and social responsibility haven't come a part of it so far, so why should they now? And that is true. You're right, Hugh, that they haven't been a part of the conversation before, so why should they now? What's interesting with this is that if you compare it to the Newcastle takeover, yes, that was widely trailed and discussed over many, many years. But from a story point of view, it just happened, didn't it? It just happened. We were told it was happening. Wow, Newcastle have been taken over. This Chelsea takeover, it's almost like a kind of auction. It's like a daytime TV auction. It's absolutely bizarre. So you have all these contenders throwing their name into the hat. As we discussed with Martin Ziegler before, the cynic in me thinks that a lot of them have been throwing their name into the hat in order to project their own image, company or whatever into the spotlight a bit more. Interestingly, because of the size of Chelsea as a club, a lot of the conversations we're having now about the social responsibility, the morals, the ethics of the owners, how much that is a factor in who gets it will come down to the Chelsea fans themselves. The Chelsea fans who, let's be honest, were a big part of the crushing of the European Super League. We all remember those images outside Stamford Bridge. But equally, in some sectors of the Chelsea support haven't covered themselves in glory with the reactions to the Russian sanctions. It'll be interesting when we get the three group shortlist, whether the conversation is who's got the most money? Who's got the most money? Or whether the conversation is, what are these people like? Like, what are their, you know, what are their social goals? What are their views on social responsibilities? That comes down to us as journalists. That's our responsibility too, to ask those questions. So but the cynic in me ultimately thinks that when we get these the shortlist, it'll be how much money have they got, who's going to be the best fit to keep Chelsea as the Chelsea that they are.
Honestly, I was speaking to a Chelsea fan about this yesterday, and I said, how many people are really going to buy a club for the amount of money that they're probably going to have to buy Chelsea for out of the sheer love of football? I mean, so we have to really think about the considerations here. For me, it's going to boil down to, what are your plans? Are you going to build a new stadium? And is it going to be on the site of Stamford Bridge, or are you just doing this as a property deal? you know, or, you know, I think, because I think a lot of people are buying it, seeing an opportunity that exists outside football, because to put it simply, you're not going to make a lot of money from Chelsea. I mean, and if it's a deal like, for example, the Glazers have done with Manchester United, then I think that should rule you out immediately. You know, I don't think you should buy the club with a lot of leveraged debt, for example. So Chelsea are in a big hole. They need to get out of it. And I think we need to be pragmatic and say, in the business world, the things that are going to be at the bottom of the list are the things that you've said that are totally wrong in the past and have apologized for. It's not going to count them out. Again, I think there should be some ethical considerations, some moral considerations, some societal considerations, certainly. I just don't see that happening this week. Those rules don't exist. And I just don't see how you can apply that. I almost, like I say, it sounds really weird. I can't think of another word. I'm just not smart enough. It would seem unfair on those at Chelsea and the fans to count someone out when you're not counting out ownership groups, wealthy ownership groups elsewhere in the Premier League for ethical considerations. I don't know what else to say, really.
Yeah, look, I get all that, Hugh. And this comes down to almost like a philosophical point. The owner's test in the Premier League is no different to, you know, who can buy a British company. And essentially, it just comes down to financial fitness. And what we're now what we're talking about, really, you and I, sort of the same thing, is trying to almost retrofit the system so that an ethical consideration does come into it. And I guess it's whether you do it now or whether you try and legislate for it. And I think there's a wider debate to be had as to whether football and fans need to actually take some responsibility here. Do they want football to be different? I do, but do the fans want it to be different to just another field of business and to the ownership of a football club, a football club to represent something a little bit more than a transactional commercial business does? And there's so many things that spin off that. We just mentioned Declan Rice and transfers. You know, it strikes me that we could have some ethical buyers of Chelsea who then can't afford Declan Rice in the summer and get criticised for not spending enough money. And you know, I've seen some Chelsea fans really getting behind the Saudi media group bid because they want to be another Newcastle. So fans have got to answer these questions. What do they actually want? I know what I want. And I don't want football to just be who's got the most money, don't care what else there is to them as long as the ward is there. I think there has to be something more to it. And it's, you know, I mentioned this being an opportunity. It just strikes me that it might be easier, just from a pragmatic point of view, to do it by precedent than to try and get some legislation through. But I don't know. We talk about this a lot, don't we? And I'm sure, you know, we're going to be debating. We have the same dilemma throughout the year as we always do. You know, we want the clubs to spend money, and yet we'd sort of complain when the owners aren't up to scratch.
Well, thank you, Johnny. And listen, I know you've been with us from the back of a limousine as you've been on your way to the Etihad. I know you can't join us for any longer. Gotta go to work. But thank you very much for joining us on the Game Podcast. For all of you listening, there is still more to come. We'll get the latest on the Women's Champions League and an update on Manchester United's managerial search. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This This week, there have been big games in the Women's Champions League. Arsenal are flying the flag for Britain in the competition, and they salvaged a 1-1 draw at home to Wolfsburg, thanks to a very, very late goal. Molly Hudson was there for the Times. Hi, Molly.
Hi, you.
Good result for Arsenal, do you think? What about their performance?
Yeah, I think it was a really good result in a sense of the fact that they played pretty well through the game, and Wolfsburg's goal was kind of a very clinical finish. I think a lot of their play kind of showed their experience in Europe last night. And I think there was a bit of a worry that perhaps Arsenal would, you know, play pretty well and end up coming away from that game with nothing. And I think that's what was really important. And obviously the fact that Lotta Ubemoy got that late goal, you know, as a lifelong Arsenal fan at the Emirates, it was just a really lovely moment. And I think the kind of celebrations reflected how important that could be with the tie now, you know, completely open heading to Germany next week.
Do you think that it's a chance that Arsenal go through, a good chance that they'll go through? Because as you mentioned, Wolfsburg do have more of the experience at this level of competition.
Yeah, I think most people would have had Wolfsburg as the favourites. And I think that was fair to say even before the game, you know, last night we were saying, you know, the chances are, you know, Arsenal could get beat here. But I think with Arsenal, the fact that they're not very experienced, they have this ability on their day to kind of beat pretty much anyone. But it's just finding that consistency and being able to produce it on the big platform, big moments. And I think last night they did a decent job of that. So I think now they'll really take confidence from that, knowing that they've gone toe-to-toe with Wolfsburg. And I think Jonas Eidevall said last night after the game, it took them a while to almost grow into the game. And I think they really will take confidence from that going into the second leg. But, you know, we saw what Wolfsburg did to Chelsea in the second leg, you know, absolutely thrashed them 4-0. So I think we know how dangerous Wolfsburg can be. But yeah, the tie is totally open going into that second leg.
Would be good to see a WSL team progress, but it is a big task for Arsenal. Let's talk about some of the other matches in the Champions League this week. Elsewhere, Paris Saint-Germain won at Bayern, Juve won at home to Lyon, Barcelona won the El Clasico 3-1 away from home as well. I think we'll come to maybe Barcelona on their own. Juventus beating Lyon, is that the shock of the round, maybe?
Yeah, it is. And I kind of watched a little bit of that game from the Emirates last night. And I think it's testament to, firstly, obviously, there was a red card for Lyon, which obviously played a big part. But I think it's a testament to the work that Joe Montemurro, the former Arsenal manager, is doing at Juventus. They've had a really good season. And particularly when you frame it in a sense of the fact that the Italian league isn't professional yet. I think the work that they've done to kind of compete with the very best teams in Europe is really admirable. And I think Joe's doing really well out there. And it's kind of a team that has a lot of talent without having big standout names, I suppose. And the way that the kind of team is working together is really impressive. And we saw a little bit of that when, obviously, Chelsea played Juventus in the group stages. And I think, yeah, they're really built on that. And I think, actually, what we've seen from quite a lot of Italian women's teams is how good they can be defensively. So I think that's a really difficult tie, actually, for Lyon going into that second leg, knowing that they've got to score goals, knowing they've got to get something. I think Juventus could kind of pull off a really big shock there.
Paris Saint-Germain winning at Bayern as well is probably expected, is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think Nkatoto, who scored for PSG, you know, they have an incredible talent there. And I think, having seen how well Lyon have done in the French league, PSG are really challenging them now and have kind of grown in recent years. So I think, yeah, I think it was probably to be expected that PSG would win that one. But, you know, the strength and depth in European teams is growing all the time. And I think that's kind of reflected across all of these ties this time around.
And Barcelona allowed us to think that there might be a shock on the cards for a little bit before pulling away right at the death. 3-1 win over Real Madrid. They're just going to be the team to beat in this year's competition for you?
I think so, yeah. I think, look, they've already won the league in Spain you know, they won it 2 weeks ago. And I think if you can win any kind of top league in Europe this early, it shows kind of how good you are. They kind of haven't put a foot wrong, other than, you know, maybe the opening stages of that game the other night. Actually, I think a lot of people were kind of watching it thinking, you know, wow, we was expecting Barcelona to win quite comfortably. But actually, they kind of found a way. And I think that probably sums up Barcelona at the moment, where when everything was against them, they kind of plucked a pretty controversial penalty that kind of got the equaliser. And then from there on in, you know, it was only going to end one way, I think. So, and I also think they've just got so much talent on the pitch, you know, Alexia Putellas, Caroline Graham-Hansen, just so many talented players that even when it is going against you, you know, you've got the talent on the pitch to kind of pull out of the bag. So I think, yeah, I think they've just got so much confidence, and I think they're definitely the team to beat.
Yeah, 24 wins out of 24 in the league in Spain. All the focus now on European competition for them. We do have second legs to come next week, so we'll speak again at that point, Molly, see if the predictions come to light. There is one other thing I wanted to speak to you about, though. Arda Hegerberg is back for Norway after, I think, a five-year absence. What does that mean for international women's football?
I think it's brilliant, and I think it's brilliant because ultimately what you want, and we see this in the men's game as well, that, you know, sometimes you get very talented players that are with nations that for whatever reason don't qualify for tournaments. And I think ultimately you just want the best players in the biggest tournaments. And, you know, Ada Hegerberg is one of the very best in the world. Obviously was the best in the world before she got injured and was out for a little while. She's getting back to her best now. I think that it's just fantastic to see her, you know, at a tournament. And I think it's so important in the women's game that she did stand up and she did say, actually, no, I'm not going to play because I don't believe the conditions that are available to the players are good enough. So I think it's also really a positive step that she clearly feels as though enough has changed for her mind to change. And I think for all of us watching, you know, whether as fans or in the media, it's just a brilliant step to see her back on the international stage because, you know, she's such a fantastic player. And actually, you know, we've seen how good Norway have been without Ada. So imagine how good they can be with her.
Yeah, she's been an unbelievable player, of course. UEFA best women's player in 2016, the first female player to win the new Ballon d'Or, if you like, saying today, I love football. I want to play football. I took a decision in 2017 that I stood by, but I had a lot of time to reflect over the past 2 years on many aspects. And I've had very honest discussions with the Federation. I'm very glad to be able to come back with the team and get a new story started. And let's see what she does produce with a great nation in Norway. Molly Hudson, thank you so much for joining us for that update on the Game podcast. As I say, in a week's time, we will know who is through to what, the final four in the Champions League. So we shall see. We'll speak to you then. Take care. Manchester United's managerial search finally feels real. It's been put off like a piece of university coursework, and now John Murto and Richard Arnold are in their library pulling an all-nighter, trying to get it over the line. Paul Hurst joins us for an update on what will hopefully be one of the big stories in the next few weeks rather than months. Hursty, the Ajax boss, Erik ten Hag, has done an interview. Because clearly, we can't judge what a manager is like from the hours and hours of footage of their team playing.
Yeah, it is a bit strange, isn't it? Talking about it, you know, like you said, there has been a vacancy since November, and it's taken them till March to actually start talking to people. So the process is finally underway. Erik ten Hag was interviewed on Monday, and we believe it went well, or, you know, Ten Hag thought he made a good impression and United were quite impressed by him from what I hear. So he's the first of four, we think. You know, United are at pains to say that that they've not made a decision, that he's still a four horse race. That's what we've been told anyway. So it's But you know, Ten Hag's got his foot in the door. He's made a good impression to start off with. So, you know, that's he's laid down a kind of early marker, I guess. And, you know, in many ways, he does kind of fit the United model. You know, he works in a similar kind of structure at Ajax, where they have a director of football who takes care of all the transfers and recruitment, etc. It's different. You know, the coach is left, the head coach is left to coach, basically. And United are sort of moving to that system at the moment, or have done over the last year. So he does fit in that respect. But, you know, we'll wait to see whether he actually gets a job.
I find it a bit weird. I mean, Man United, calling it a four-horse race, suggests to me that they don't know what kind of manager they really want. I mean, how much of this is going to be about the interview process? Because, like I say, you should know a lot about these coaches already. So the idea that you sit down with them and what? It's all carte blanche between the four of them, is it? You know, everyone starts on the same footing. I don't think so.
But I think it works the other way as well, doesn't it? They want to know whether, like Richard Arnold and John Murtagh, et cetera, will want to know whether they are, you know, whether Ten Hag is really wants the job. You know, does he really want to make this step up from Ajax, which, you know, is a big club, but it's not one of the biggest clubs, which United is. Does he really want it? You know, can they get a feel for actually whether he would be able to deal with the pressure of being a Man United manager? Does Pochettino want it really, or is he kind of, you know, is he flirting with them to get the Real Madrid job? Would Luis Enrique give his job up before the end of the season, which, you know, from what I'm told, is unlikely, that he'd leave Spain before the World Cup? And then Julian Lopetegui as well. Does he really want it? Has he got a plan for United moving forward? So I think you can gauge a lot from Swan's personality in an interview, isn't it? You know, this is the guy who, you know, they'll be given a really big job to. You know, this is a huge appointment for the club and for Richard Arnold as well. You know, this will go a long way to defining his career as chief exec of Man United.
Is the Thomas Tuchel dream dead? Because that was in the headlines not too long ago.
Basically, if Tuchel was available, they'd get him. I don't think there would be an issue with that. You know, Tuchel is obviously got a very good track record, won the Champions League with Chelsea, and his style of play is very good as well. It kind of fits with United's, and I've had conversations with people high up at United's over the last couple of years, and Tuchel's name has always been mentioned as one of the best coaches in the world, and they're aware of him and they're a fan of him. But I don't really know how he can get him out of Chelsea at the moment. No one really knows what's going to happen with Chelsea, do they? You know, Tuchel probably doesn't know himself. So I think it would be a bit presumptuous of United to go for him and then, you know, not get him. They'd look pretty silly, I would say. And, you know, this is looking from the outside, but you look at all the bidders that are lining up for Chelsea, they all seem to have a lot of money or seem to be quite well backed. So, you know, who's to say that there might not be actually that much difference to Tuchel's role under the new ownership at Chelsea than the one he's got now?
Just quickly on this, I just want to understand the process then. Mauricio Pochettino, Luis Enrique, Lopetegui, they're all going to have interviews, are they? Or is Erik ten Hag the only one that's going to have to go through this? I mean, I know there's going to be conversations, but the others have jobs. So you either go for them and you pull them out of their jobs, or I just don't understand it, because in the history, in my mind, of how it works, you go for a manager that's got a job, you have to speak to the club, you've got to pay compensation, you've got to go all through all of those things before you bring them in. The idea that it's an interview process, it's like you're interviewing four people that need a job and they don't.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It is. I did find it strange that, you know, that this has come out now, that this is actually happening. You know, Ten Hag's got a job, hasn't he? You know, he's in a position, he's got another, you know, year and a half left on his Ajax contract. But we're told that Ajax gave United their blessing, but that's only because they've got a good relationship with the club. Edwin van der Sar gets on well with, you know, clearly everyone at United. There's a link there. But, you know, if I was PSG, I know Pochettino, you know, isn't flavour of the month there at the moment, but I'd be thinking, yeah, well, he's our manager. You know, I mean, if you want to get him, you've got to pay his compensation, etc. So yeah, he would take the, you know, take the say so of the clubs, would take the agreement of the clubs, you know, of PSG, of Sevilla, and Spain, the national federation as well, for Man United to speak to these managers.
Tom, what do you think's going on with United? Is it more indecision?
It's definitely indecision, but I'm trying to work out, listening to some of Hirsty's points and your points, Hugh, and trying to wonder where it comes from, because I just wonder whether, you know, they've gone down so many different routes in terms of managerial choices post Alex Ferguson, that I almost wonder whether, because of the change at the top as well, you know, as Hirsty says, with Richard Arnold replacing Ed Woodward, you know, this kind of new era feel, people like Darren Fletcher being in place. I wonder whether, Hirsty, obviously you can kind of shed more light on this. It's almost like they're trying very, very hard to be seen as being meticulous and well prepared, and not just plump for Mourinho or plump for Solskjaer, or, you know, two very different types of managers with a different approach, different ethos, and, you know, a different brand of club, if you like. But it's almost like, you know, Hugh's mentioned it, this how strange process. Hirsty, you mentioned not looking stupid. I almost wonder whether they're kind of like psyching themselves out here. Like are they overthinking it almost, Hirsty, do you reckon?
Well, I think they've been, you know, they've been thorough. And like you said, they, in the past, they've been, you know, directed by almost by emotion too much, you know, with their, you know, with Solskjaer in particular. You know, he wasn't good enough for that job, was he? You know, but because they beat PSG and he managed to get them in the Champions League, then, you know, that was enough, basically. Or, you know, they had that kind of glimmer of hope with Ollie, and they, you know, they put everything, all their faith in him. And with Mourinho as well, it was like, right, he's available, so we should get him. You know, he's won loads of things, without really kind of giving much thought to whether it'd actually work or not. You know, it's. So I, you know, in this instance, it is strange, as I said, that they're, you know, interviewing people who already have other jobs. But I think it's a fair process in, you know, talking to these people. You know, you want to have the best picture possible of these managers before you offer them the job, because it's such a huge role.
Hirsty, can I just ask as well? I was thinking about, you know, you've followed United for a long time now, and particularly through all this period, and, you know, you and I have talked about them through various different managers, and me and the editors often ring you up and go, right, we need you to write this piece on what needs to happen for Manchester United, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, what if you could think about one or two qualities that you think as a coach, rather than picking which of these people do you think, having watched them so much and seen so much turmoil at the club, what would be the one or two qualities of a manager that you would be thinking that's what they need?
I would want a manager who unifies the dressing room. That would be my number one priority. That I would want a charismatic personality, a leader who has experience and has won things, and, you know, really gets... It gets everyone singing off the same hymn sheet, because at the moment it's a fractured squad built up. There are players there from who have been bought by five different managers, and that is not a way to run a football club, is it? You know, five different managers, five different playing styles, and some of them are unhappy that they're playing, and some of them are unhappy that they're playing out of position. And, you know, that's coming out in the press, which is obviously great for us. I'm not complaining about that. but it's just a really bad look for the football club, isn't it? I mean, you are supposed to be the biggest club in the world, and you've got, you know, infighting and leaks, etc. So I would want someone who can bond the team, who can get, you know, get them fighting for the cause. And And just because at the moment it's really, it looks like it doesn't look like they're all pulling in the same direction. It's pretty, it's just like, oh, we'll, you know, put these players out and hopefully one of them will come up with the goods on the day. It's so yeah, that's what I would want, someone who could, you know, could make the squad, have a belief in what they're doing and have an actual direction.
Hursty, just before we end the podcast, settle a debate for us. We were talking about Declan Rice a little bit earlier on. £150 million on the back pages of the papers this week. Are Manchester United the only football club dumb enough to pay it?
No, absolutely. They won't pay that much. I would be surprised. They wouldn't go to 100 million for him. I mean, as has been pointed out, I think I was looking on Twitter, someone was saying this yesterday, that everyone was incredulous looking at that figure and saying, oh my God, 150 million, they're never going to get that for Rice. But yeah, that's the point. They don't want to sell him, so that's why they put £150 million price tag on him. So, but yeah, United wouldn't go for that high. You know, I don't think anyone would. City certainly wouldn't. Yeah, they wouldn't go that high for Harry Kane. So I just think, yeah, that defensive midfield slot is the biggest weakness in the team at the moment. But they wouldn't go that high for Declan Rice, or, you know, however good a player that he is.
Okay, that solved it. So when they pay, what, 125 in a few months' time?
Yeah, when they pay 149 and they get him, you can come to me and say, well, you were almost right. 150 million, I wouldn't put any of your own money on that happening.
Brilliant. Paul Hurst, as always, thank you for joining us on the Game Podcast. Tom Clark, thank you as well. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back on Monday with much more. But remember, you can enjoy some of our brighter insights on politics, business, and more. For just £1, you can get 3 months of everything, a subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. Subscribe now at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you next week.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.